You have a Bible or a way to access your Bible on your app or another device. We're going to be in John chapter 13 this morning, and we're going to be finishing this series. We've been going through this series called No Turning Back. And we started literally on what would be Palm Sunday, which is today, the day Jesus comes in to Jerusalem and the crowd was there. And I talked about all of the different detours that were put before Jesus. And we're going to look at another one of those this morning. As you find your way in your Bible to John 13, I just heard about a couple of guys that were playing golf this week, and you know, they're out on the golf course, and I don't know how much you know about golf, but one of the guys had gotten all the way up to the green, and he was about to chip the ball in when he saw a funeral procession coming, and he stopped, and he took off his hat, and he bowed his head, and he began to pray, till the funeral procession went by, and his friend said, "Wow, I've never seen you do anything that kind before." And he said, "Well, you know, to tell you the truth, it's really the least I could do considering the fact that we've been married for 35 years. Well, some of you will get that in a minute, maybe. I don't know. But, you know, Jesus was on earth for 33 years. And the last 3 years of his life, as far as we know on earth, he had spent almost every moment with these individuals we call his disciples. And there are various disciples that we get to know a little bit about in each of the Gospels. But there's one man we don't know very much about that we're going to look at tonight. And the scene that's set for us in the Gospel is the Last Supper. Jesus is reclining at the table. It's not like Da Vinci painted, you know, this big long table with big high back chairs. It's low to the ground and it's in the shape of a U. The Greeks called it the triclinium. And you put your feet behind you when you eat, and you lean on your left elbow on like a little couch, and you eat at the table. It's kind of like when you're kids and you're eating popcorn, watching a movie, you know? And they're just sort of reclining around the table, but everything around the table is very important. If you're on the right hand, you're in a very important position. The gospel will tell us that sitting at Jesus' right hand was the beloved disciple. It tells us that he had a conversation with a guy named Peter. Simon Peter. So he must have been sitting a little bit further from him. But it doesn't ever tell us who sits at his left. The left hand was actually, at the table, the most important location. And it's kind of interesting that the text doesn't tell us who was sitting there at his left, but it does tell us that while the meal was taking place, Jesus took a morsel or a piece of bread some of the old translations say a sop, which is just the best piece of meat or the best piece of bread. You know, when you're getting your bowl of chips and you just get that really good chip, or when you're in with French fries, you know, I like cheese fries, you know, you just really get one with a lot of cheese on it and put it in that ranch. Boy, that's really good. I'd really hesitate to share that with anybody, to be honest with you. But what Jesus does is really amazing. He takes it and he dips it and he gives it to the person on his left. And the gospel will tell us that the person that he gives it to, his name is Judas Iscariot. And it's all of a sudden you realize something really important that's happening here. And the gospels really never say this, but the disciple apparently who Jesus trusted the most was Judas. The person who the other disciples regarded the most highly was actually Judas. And Judas is the one who is sitting there next to Jesus. Let's read about what happens here in John chapter 13, verse 18. Jesus said, "I'm not referring to all of you. I know that those I have chosen, but this is to fulfill the passage, 'He who has shared my bread has turned against me.' I'm telling you now before it happens, so that when it does happen, you will believe that I am who I am. Very truly I tell you, whoever accepts anyone I send accepts me, and whoever accepts me accepts the one who sent me." And after he had said this, Jesus was troubled in spirit. Now that phrase, Jesus was troubled in spirit, is the same kind of description of Jesus when he came to the tomb of Lazarus and his friend was dead and he was just moved in his heart. This is the very human Jesus we meet here. He was troubled. Anybody who's ever been troubled, Jesus understands what it feels like to be troubled. He was troubled in spirit. And he didn't just talk. The text tells us he testified. "Very truly, I tell you, one of you is going to betray me." You just imagine what that was like in that moment when they heard that. And his disciples stared at one another at a loss to know which of them he meant. And one of them, the disciple whom Jesus loved, the beloved disciple, he was reclining next to him. Simon Peter mentioned to this disciple and said, "Hey, ask him which one he means." Can you just see Peter doing that? Which one is he talking about? Leaning back. So, beloved disciple is reclining there on his left hand. Jesus is right here, and he leans back to whisper, "Lord, who is it?" And Jesus answered, "It is the one whom I will give this piece of bread." Now, the word bread could also mean morsel, or the old King James just says sop. It's just that really choice piece of food that I told you about. The one I give this piece of bread, well, when I have dipped it in the dish, and then dipping the piece of bread, he gave it to Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot. And as soon as Judas took the bread, Satan entered into him. So Jesus told him, "What are you about to do? What you are about to do, do it quickly." But no one at the meal understood why Jesus said this to him, since Judas had charge of the money. That just shows you right there that he was the most trusted member of the whole group. Some thought Jesus was telling him to buy what was needed for the festival or to give something to the poor. And as soon as Judas had taken the bread, he went out. And notice what the gospel says next. And it was night. The darkness has set in. It's not just night outside in the gospel. The night has finally come. As we look at this story this morning, the focus is on that dish. It's on that container. It's on that bread or morsel or whatever it was that was put into that cup. And this morning, just real quickly, I want to just sort of extract out of that scene some of the things that are true for us today to understand. First of all, as this happens, this becomes a prediction. It is a prediction. Verse 18, verse 19, verse 21, verse 26, and verse 27 all tell us it's a prediction. Now, I'm going to say something that's not going to sound really shocking to any of you, but I'm just going to say it anyway, and you might be surprised to know that this is not something that the Bible frequently says. But this passage shows us very clearly that God knows the future. Now, probably a lot of us in this room would say, "Well, yeah, of course God knows the future. He's God." But you know, you'd actually be kind of hard-pressed in the Bible if you started in Genesis and went all the way to Revelation to find a verse in the Bible that says, "And by the way, God knows everything that's going to happen in the future." You know, we just kind of assume that about God. We kind of think that about God, but there aren't a whole lot of verses that actually indicate that. When I was in seminary, this is the year 2018, the year 2000, I started going to seminary down in Waco. And when I got to seminary, the denominations and the theologians were debating the question, does God know the future? And in all our theology classes, we had to read books about this because everybody was talking about, does God know the future? Now, on our faculty there at the seminary, there were some people who are what you call Calvinists. They believe that God not only knows the future, but he controls the future. He's in charge of everything that happens. And we had wonderful theologians that had that view. We also had on our faculty people who didn't believe that, people who believe that God knows the future, but he doesn't control everything that happens, sometimes referred to as Arminians. But the debate that was happening was, is the future just wide open? It's called open theism. Maybe you've heard about it, but it's just the belief that God knows all the possible futures, like a supercomputer figuring out chess moves in advance, but he just doesn't know which one it's going to be. And it's called open theism. And I remember sitting in theology class with Roger Olson, who's one of the leading theologians in the world, and Dr. Olson brought up the discussion about it, and he said, "I just finished writing an article to go in Christianity Today, which is the leading Christian magazine in the world, on this topic." And he said, "I've come to explain my conclusion that God does know the future." And he said, the place that it's clearest in all of Scripture is at the Last Supper, when Jesus predicts that Peter will betray him, will deny him, and Judas will betray him. And so it's amazing to see this passage tonight, today to realize that on that night, he was knowing what was going to happen in the future. God knows the future. But that also, what's interesting in the story is it's really making something else clear to us. And that is that God gives us free will. Isn't it interesting that in this moment, Jesus is still giving Judas the morsel? He's still giving him another chance. He's still giving him another option. "Okay, Judas, you don't have to do this. You don't have to go through all of this." But Judas is doing it anyway. Every once in a while, you'll be listening to the news and you'll hear somebody do some horrible thing, and they'll get on the radio, they'll get on the microphone and they'll say, "Why did you do it?" And they'll say this, "The devil made me do it." Now, you know, that might get you out of some trouble some places, but that will never get Judas out of trouble. You know why? Because the Bible says here that Judas made the decision that he made, and then Satan entered into him. He chose, and then Satan entered into him. It wasn't the devil making him do it. Jesus knew it was going to happen, and he predicted it. Now, this moment is not just a prediction, though. It is also a betrayal. As he shared that cup, as he shared that dish, as he shared that morsel, this becomes one of the awesome moments of betrayal ever. If you study history, you know that there are some famous betrayals. The Rosenbergs were the famous Soviet spies that spied on the U.S. for the Soviets. You may know the Aztec story of the famous slave who became the wife of Cortez, the Spanish conqueror, and she translated into that language, from that language, how to defeat the Aztec people. And she's regarded La Malinche as one of the most evil betrayers in all of history. And then, of course, probably the most famous is that of the Roman Caesar, who was betrayed by his close friends. Julius Caesar, as depicted by William Shakespeare in that famous play, Shakespeare describes it and accurately describes the scene, according to the historian Suetonius, that Caesar comes in and then he's surrounded by his friends. There's Marcius Brutus, there's Cassius, and they all gather around him with daggers in hand. Some of you have seen the plays, some of you may have even been in the plays or seen the movie. And there's a moment where Caesar sees the daggers and he's going to resist. I mean, all of us would want to. But then when he sees his young protege, his dear friend, Marcius Brutus, is among those betraying him, he famously says, and now there's a question as to what he says. The Roman historian Suetonius says he didn't say anything. But the other Roman historian said he said this. He said, "You also, my child, my son." But William Shakespeare turned it into Latin and very famously said what? "Et tu, Brute." "You too, Brutus." In that moment, Caesar just said, "I'm not going to resist anymore. Go ahead and kill me. If my closest friend betrays me, I'm not going to resist anymore. Just go ahead." I want you to understand something this moment. As Jesus was looking at, sitting next to, eating with the man who was going to betray him, Jesus did not do what Caesar did. He didn't just give up. In fact, even in the face of betrayal, there was no turning back. The world behind him, the cross before him, there was no turning back on the part of Jesus. Now, if you were an investigator and you'd come up to the crime after it had taken place and you wanted to try to figure out, well, why did Judas do this? You wanted to know what every investigator wants to know, that is the motivation or the motive. You'd have found all kinds of different motives. But the text tells us that there was one principal reason. In John chapter 12, a chapter earlier, it says that he did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief, a keeper of the money bag, and he used to help himself to what was put in it. His principal motive was money. He just wanted one of those silver coins for himself. He wanted one of those Tyrian shekels, or the stater of Antioch that had the face, not of George Washington on it, but of Augustus Caesar. Or he wanted one of those Egyptian Ptolemaic tetradrachms. He did it for silver coins. And in fact, not just for one or for 10 or for 20, but for how many? For 30. That's a very important number because in the Old Testament, in the law, in the book of Exodus chapter 21, it says that if a man's slave is out in a field and an ox or an animal comes and it kills the slave, to pay for that, you have to pay 30 pieces of silver. It's the price of a slave. And then also we read in the book of Genesis, when Israel or Jacob had those sons, and he had that one son named Joseph, and the other brothers were mad and envious, and they wanted to kill him, but instead they decided to sell him as a slave for how much? 30 pieces of silver. So what's happening to Jesus is what happened to Israel. The reenactment of the story. The ultimate betrayal. For 30 pieces of silver, for the price of a slave, Jesus will be betrayed by his close ally, Judas. Now, the other thing that you'd be interested in, if you're an investigator, is how did it happen? How did the crime take place? What did he do? What was the method used? And you could think of all kinds of different methods you'd want to use. You know, maybe he would have drawn a map and told the, this is where you can find Jesus, or written out on an itinerary, go get him right here. But they had already arranged a method, and it was a kiss, wasn't it? In the Garden of Gethsemane, that night, just a few hours later, Judas Iscariot would walk a battalion of Roman soldiers, temple guards, and they would follow behind Judas. And in the darkness of the garden, Judas would come up to Jesus, and he'd kiss him, and they would know to arrest him, close enough that he could smell the breath of the Son of God, close enough to kiss him. What an incredibly intimate and also powerful example of betrayal. It's such a powerful moment. Caravaggio, the Italian painter, painted the scene in vivid colors, and Dante, the Italian comedian, fiction writer that wrote the Divine Comedy, described the worst punishment in hell. Now, it's a fictional work, but the worst and lowest part of hell contained Judas Iscariot, who was constantly being devoured by dragons named Brutus and Cassius. This is the ultimate betrayal, isn't it? And you know, like all sin, it'll keep you longer when you wanted to stay and cost you more than you wanted to pay. You know that old example. And Judas also will have some consequences, and his immediate consequence is regret. In Matthew's gospel, after he takes the money and sees what happens to Jesus, he goes back and he tries to give the money back. He tries to return it, and he says in Matthew 27, verse 4, I have sinned, I have betrayed innocent blood. And they say, what's that to us? That's your responsibility. You're going to be accountable to that, not us. It's the betrayal. But now back to that scene. Jesus knows all this is going to happen. He knows what Judas is going to do. There's John sitting next to him. There's Peter. There's the other disciples. And he dips in that piece of bread or morsel or whatever it was, and he gives it to Judas. Think about that picture. The last thing you could say about that is this. What a beautiful act of grace, right? What a beautiful picture of grace. Jesus gives Judas, the one that he knows is going to betray him, the morsel to eat. Jesus knows his betrayer. But just think about it. He knows it before he ever even meets him. The first time he saw Judas, he knew that was the guy that was going to betray him. But even though, he still calls him to be his disciple and trusts him to be the treasurer. You know, the Bible tells us that we don't really know. We don't truly know who are the sheep and the goats. You know that parable in Matthew 25? Jesus says in Matthew 25, there's going to be a judgment. Right now, everybody's together. Everybody in this room, the people who are true believers and followers of Christ and the people who aren't. But on Judgment Day, there's going to be a separation, and the people who are the true followers of Christ, they're going to be rewarded, and he's going to say, come on in and to the kingdom that belongs to you, and to the other he's going to send to judgment. Right now, we don't know who's who. God knows. Hopefully you know. But I don't know. But right now, God is willing to do for you what he was willing to do for Judas at the Last Supper. He's willing to say, whoever you are, wherever you've been, whatever you've done, come to the table, take a bite, take a morsel, take a part of the grace of God today. He not only calls him, but he includes him. Isn't that amazing that he includes Judas in the Last Supper? You know, I mean, that he even brought him to dinner. I mean, some of us, if we knew somebody was going to kill us, we probably wouldn't invite him over for dinner. But he does. He includes him. He's holding out, you know, the hope that, man, maybe even Judas. You know, sometimes it comes up in the church where we have the Lord's Supper, and we're going to do it this Friday night in our special service of the cross. And people will ask, do we have an open or a closed communion? Because in some churches, when it comes time to take the Lord's Supper, they'll say, hey, if you're not a Christian, leave. because this is just for the Christians. But I've just never believed that. And part of that is because of what Jesus does right here in John's gospel. He invites everybody to come. Because I would hold out hope that maybe right in that very moment, before someone would eat that bread or drink that cup, in that very moment, they might experience the saving power of the grace of God to change their heart. And maybe this morning you came to church today, and right now, in this very moment, the grace of God is reaching out to you like the hand of Jesus, just offering you a morsel of grace. But that's not all. He not only calls him and includes him, he serves him. He serves him. I mean, he washes everybody's feet, and then he dips his morsel and gives it to the man who's going to betray him. What a picture of God's grace. There are a lot of examples of betrayal in history and in Christian history, but one of the most significant was about 400 or 500 years ago, a little bit more than 500 years ago, actually. And it was over in England. When in England in those days, there was no Bible in English. If you wanted to read a Bible, good luck. You better learn some Latin, or you better talk to a priest, because nobody's going to tell you anything about the Bible. But this guy named William Tyndale had a vision. He wanted to bring the Bible into English. And they kicked him out of England for it, and they were hunting him. And he went to stay in Germany, and Martin Luther protected him, and he was translating the Bible into English. But he would eventually be captured. And he would be betrayed by one of his own friends who he entrusted, who he believed was also concerned about doing the work that he wanted to do. And he was handed over and put in prison, and then he was strangled and burned at the stake. William Tyndale. Just as he was dying, Tyndale very famously said, "Lord, open the King of England's eyes." And do you know that prayer was answered? Because the work that he had done translating the Bible into English would become what the King of England, would then known as King James, would officially recognize, which is the King James Version of the Bible, and put his stamp of approval on it. And then people all over England, and then eventually all over America and around the world, would be impacted by the work of this man. And I think if you ask if Tyndale could come back and you could say, "Tyndale, would you have done it anyway? Would you have translated the Bible even if you knew you were going to be strangled and burned at the stake?" I think he would say, "You know what? No turning back." Right? The world behind me, the cross before me, I would do it 1,000 times over. Because when Tyndale translated the Bible into English for the first time in a remarkable way, all of us, as a result of it, now have an access to this book. And it changed history. In fact, if you were to study history, you would learn that Tyndale's translation and the King James translation changed history, especially English history, more than any other event in almost 500 years. Well, what about you today? Jesus Christ is before us, not physically, but spiritually, offering to us the morsel of grace. He's offering to us, saying, "Come and eat. Come and be a part of what I'm offering you today." I hope you won't turn him down.